I am Elsa, and I am a very grateful member of Al-Anon. Hi. This is the funniest combination that I've ever seen. I've known Winnie for a long, long time. And I've loved her for a long, long time. But this is the first time that we've ever been billed on the same program. I remember so well a good many years ago when Winnie came down to talk to our group in Laguna. And she said during her talk, you know, I've known Elsa for a long time. And I used to look at her and wonder if she was as serene on the inside as she looked on the outside. And I had to go up and tell her afterwards that at that time that she was speaking about, I definitely was not as serene on the inside as I looked on the outside. Because for many, many years, one of the things that I think gave me the most trouble that I ever had was that facade that I carried for so very, very long. And if it hadn't been for Al-Anon having the patience and the time and the years to show me what I needed to change and what I needed to do, I probably would still be going around with that lovely facade. I'm so serene and I'm eaten up inside. And I think that's the story that most of us have to tell. When I was very young and very, very naive and inexperienced, I met a young man that a great many of you know and have heard many times. He was tall and he was handsome and he was charming and he was an idealist and he was a perfectionist and he had all of the attributes that I thought I wanted, and I fell head over heels in love with a very, very wonderful guy. We eventually got married, and the funny part of it is that I was so surprised that he would even look at me, because in those days, when I was a kid, and somebody reminded me of this yesterday in one of the meetings here, she had been a tomboy, and I had been a tomboy, and I had forgotten that for a long time, and I haven't mentioned it for a long time. But she was the youngest, a girl with several brothers, and I was an only. And sometimes I think that an only child has a rougher time of it than those that are raised with brothers and sisters. But I was a tomboy, and I was very much interested in athletics of all kinds. Swimming was my big department, but along with that, and I haven't told this for a long time either, along with that, my only talents really laid in the artistic field of art, drama, and music. Now, when you have a combination like that, you're bound to be a pretty mixed-up person, believe me. But when I fell in love with this guy, I fell in love just all over, because this was my first real love affair. And I married this man, and along the way, we had two beautiful boys. And I can't say that the early years of our marriage were bad, because they weren't. Chuck and I were going through that Great Depression that some of you may remember. And we didn't have too much money to spend on booze. So the difficulty that we had with alcohol grew very slowly and very gradually. And one of the things that I would say is that I know without the shadow of a doubt that alcoholism is a progressive illness, because I have watched that over many, many years. And to watch a very, very fine, wonderful person gradually by degrees over the years fall apart is a pretty sad and heartbreaking experience. And when you have stars in your eyes, as I had, and had those pictures of what life was going to be, we were going to have beautiful children, life was going to be a ball, and everything was going to be fine. And then to have it just disintegrate little by little by little over the years is not the easiest thing in the world to go through, especially in the day that I grew up in those years. Because those were the days when no one knew anything about alcoholism. We had no answers, none whatsoever. And everybody just looked down their noses at the alcoholic and called them common, ordinary, dirty drunks. And we had no sympathy for and no understanding of and no compassion. And it was a rather ugly time for the alcoholic. I wonder sometimes if you people in Al-Anon today are as grateful for this program as you should be. Because you see, I'm in a position to know what it's like when there is no answer. And today you have the experience and the knowledge of quite a few years of trial and error in this program, and the knowledge that AA has given us to help you through a situation that is very, very difficult. And to me, the whole basis of Al-Anon is finding your own peace and your own joy and your own peace of mind in spite of what might be going on at home. And I am sure there probably are people here who are still living with practicing alcoholics. And if there is anything in the world that I can say or do that will help you to understand the difference between not having an answer and having an answer, hopefully that's what I will be able to do in the few minutes that I have. The last 10 years of Chuck's drinking was periodic. And I sometimes think that it's more difficult to live with a periodic drinker than it is with a daily drinker. At least with a daily drinker, you know exactly what's going to happen. But with a periodic, you never know. You never know. So you're pulled up and down and up and down. And every time he would sober up, I would think, ah, now he has the answer. Everything's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. And then, of course, about a week or two before the next one would start, I would begin to see the signs. Have any of you done that? He would be getting a little picky, a little critical, a little judgmental, and apparently he was trying to pick a fight with me. And we have learned that the alcoholic is very adept at pushing our buttons. And you see, I didn't know that he had to have an excuse. He had to have someone to blame. And so I took it very seriously and didn't like it one bit. If there's any mistake that any one of you have ever made, I made it. I doubt very much if I ever did any of the right things, but I certainly was very adept at doing the wrong things. Fortunately, I guess in our experience, at the last of those 10 years, it had gotten so bad that I was forced into a corner that I could not get out of, and I had to make a decision. You know, that decision was very hard to come by because I had threatened many, many, many times to leave or to push him out and had never done anything about it. And it's kind of like crying wolf, wolf, you know. It gets to the place after a while where they don't believe you. But this time I was completely and totally done. I thought I hated this man. I thought I actually despised him because an alcoholic is not a very pretty thing to live with. They're not very pretty to look at. And so here I was, boxed in. And I finally had to make a decision that this time I was all done. And I told him so, and I sought a lawyer, and I started divorce proceedings, and I started the business school. Today, I can see exactly what I did at that time. I can see that actually I gave up completely. I did exactly the same thing, I think, that the alcoholic does when they give up and come to this program. I gave up the necessity, and I would like to underscore that word necessity, the necessity for Chuck to ever get sober. I didn't think he ever would. But along with that, I gave up the necessity to keep the family together. But most of all, and I think this is the most meaningful thing to most women, I gave up the necessity to be taken care of. And I think that's one of the biggest ones, because most women, I think, have that feeling of being dependent on being taken care of, at least the women who come from my era. Because I was raised by a Southern father who was born in Georgia, and I was taught that women did not work, and that women were meant to be mothers and housewives and companions, and that was it, period. The very thought of going to work just scared the living daylights out of me. But the thing that I see so clearly today, because you have taught me many things, I see that the thing that I hated was not the man. It was not the man that I had loved so very, very dearly that I hated. It was the sickness. It was the disease. And that, I think, is the thing that makes it possible when they do come to the program and get sober, for us to find that we do not hate the man, we hate the disease. And it's possible then, again, to learn to love and to cherish and to enjoy the man we fell in love with in the first place. Chuck and I were in the East talking at a conference several years ago, and a man there, an alcoholic, in his talk said something that just almost knocked me off my seat. He said, so many of us come to this program and get good before we get well. And I think that's so true, so very, very true. And that's the story of my life. And the thing that I want to stress is that it's so easy, so very, very easy to come to this program and get a very, very fine intellectual knowledge and think you know the whole bit. And you can have all the words and you know all the stories, you know all the ideas and the ideals and the whole bit, but you're never able really to put them into practice in your very own life, which makes the difference. I knew all the words, because you see, very shortly after I made this decision and started the divorce proceedings and gave up the necessity for Chuck to get sober, it wasn't more than a month or two before he was in the program. And the funny part of it is that he was so desperate that he grabbed this thing and ran with it, and he left me trailing way, way behind. Because by this time, I had become a complete and utter nothing. I think this is what happens to most of us who live with practicing alcoholics. It has a tendency to squash us down and squash us down and squash us down until we have no feeling of self-worth left. And that's exactly the way I came with Chuck to AA meetings. I followed him around like a little puppy dog. I was his shadow. And I've heard alcoholics say many, many times that they do not like weakness in anyone, most of all in themselves. And yet it seems as though they do everything during the practicing years to make us feel weak. And when they get us there, they don't like us anymore. And I had that feeling with Chuck. Excuse me. That he didn't have the the feeling about me that he used to have. And I spent so much time thinking that this must have been, most of this must have been my fault, because I had been blamed for it so often. So I followed Chuck to these meetings for about 5 years before Al-Anon was born. I read the book, I listened, and I had a head full of knowledge. I'd been listening to you people talk for a long time. So when we finally started our meeting, Al-Anon meeting in Beverly Hills, this was 25 years ago, believe it or not, it doesn't seem possible. I thought I knew everything, and I was the mama and the grandma of that group, and I was very adept at seeing your problem and seeing your answer, and being able to tell you what you needed to do and how you needed to do it. And then we moved. We moved down to Laguna Beach in a completely new area where I had no friends. And there was no Al-Anon. There was one meeting in Corona del Mar and one in Santa Ana at that time, and this is 20 years ago. And believe me, I was alone. And I'm not going to go into that story because a lot of you have heard it anyway. All I want to say is that I got so uncomfortable and so unhappy that I had to do something about me. And when I began to see that I couldn't live in my husband's life, and began to see that I had not changed any of the idiosyncrasies, the judgments, the criticism, the anything else that I had been saddled with all of my life, then I began to see that Chuck had not caused all of these difficulties. I could be able then to look back and see that every defect of character that I found in myself was there long before I ever met him. But they had been magnified and made worse during the experience. It's fantastic to me what can happen in this program. But in starting another group in Laguna with a completely different motive from the one that I started in Beverly Hills, you see, I started that one in Beverly Hills to help you poor people. But believe you me, the one I started in Laguna was for a very, very different reason. You didn't need me. I needed you, and I needed you desperately. And that's the thing that made it possible for me to begin to see me and to do something about it. And I think the first thing that I discovered about myself was that terrible, terrible need for approval that so many of us have, and that ghastly fear of disapproval, which was the thing that made me wear that facade and pretend to be something that I really wasn't, because I was always a little bit scared inside. And you know, a thing came out in the grapevine a good many years ago that I just love. Maybe some of you have read it because it's been repeated several times. That people wouldn't be so concerned about what other people think about them if they knew how seldom they do. We spend so much time worrying and concerned about what other people think. And one of the things that this did for me many years ago was made it possible for me to get up and talk to a group like this without that terrible necessity that you should like everything I have to say and say, oh, wasn't she wonderful, you know. It made it possible for me not to care that much, because you asked me to come and share, and I come and share, and that's it, period. And if it's lousy, that's all there was there. So it isn't necessary any longer. It's so funny to be tied up with this gal. I get the biggest kick out of it in the world because, you know, Winnie and I say a lot of the same things, but we say them in an entirely different way. And Winnie has a sense of humor that I'd give anything in the world if I had. And I asked my husband several years ago if I had a sense of humor. And you know what he said? He said, well, you're better than you used to be. Those are the kind of compliments I get from him. I began to learn many, many things. This program has saved my life. It really has. I don't know what I'd do without you. But to be able to get to the place where you can, at long last, just be what you are and not try to be something else. This competitiveness that I see all around us, I think, is one of the most devastating things that happens to us. And I remember so well when one of our dearest friends many years ago said to Chuck and me, if God had made two of us exactly alike, one of us would be unnecessary. And you know, for a long time, I had been talking about something that Chuck actually had taught me about the uniqueness of the individual. And I talked about it for a long time before I even really knew exactly what it meant. And finally, one night, Chuck and I were sitting in our living room, looking out at the view from the home on the hill that A.A. and Al-Anon had made it possible for us to have, because we came into this thing with nothing. And if we don't live too long, we'll never go hungry. And that is really something. And I might tell you this before I go any further, because I'm afraid I won't remember it to tell you, that here, after all of these years in this program, having come in with full of hate and full of bitterness, we last year celebrated our 50th wedding anniversary, and believe me, that is something. But I want to talk a little about the uniqueness of the individual, because I think this is so necessary for those of us who feel like we have to be better than, or bigger than, or like somebody else. This uniqueness is something that I think all of us need to look at. I know I had to, because I've been in competition with people all my life. I was always a people pleaser. I had to make you like me, you see, because I didn't have any liking for myself. And it's fantastic when you finally find out that each one of us is a unique child of God, and that if we do not make our own unique contribution to this life, it won't be made. That makes you pretty special, doesn't it? So really, all we have to do, and we learn how in this program, I am sure, is how to be a better you and a better me one day at a time. And that's all I think anyone would ever ask of us. And we don't have to compete, and we don't have to be like anybody else. We just be the best you know how to be, and I'm trying to be the best me I know how to be at the time. And I have a long way to go yet. But the thing that you've helped me with, too, is that people-pleasing thing. Because I have learned that there is a great difference between people-pleasing and loving people for just what's good about them and skipping the rest. That has made it so much easier for me to live with people. And it doesn't mean that you have to hide your head in the sand and say that things don't exist. You can see people with their problems. You can see people having difficulty along the way. But you give them that liberty and that freedom to learn in their own time and in their own way. And I think that's what we mean in Al-Anon when we talk about release with love. And the only way that I can express release with love as to what it means to me is to give every person in the world the dignity of God's child. The dignity to find their own answers in their own time, in their own way. Trying to help in areas where we think we can. Trying to share to the best of our ability. But to love them for what's lovable about them and skip the rest, because I have come to see that people act the way they do because they have to, not because they want to. They do not yet see themselves, because you see, I've had this experience myself. It took me so long. You see, Chuck released me from the day he got sober, and it took me 15 years to find it out. And that's a long time. I'm a slow learner. I'm the kind of a person that has to be backed absolutely into a corner that I can't get out of before I will do anything about me. I'm lazy. And it takes me a long time. I remember several years ago at our conference in Bakersfield, this was a number of years ago, when a gal spoke that made a great impression on me. She said she'd been in Al-Anon for 12 years and that her husband was still drinking. And she said, that may seem strange to you that I would stay this long with him still drinking. But she said, Al-Anon has made that possible for me to do it. And she said, I think I can express it this way. She said, supposing I had suddenly been struck blind and the doctor told me that there was a very, very faint chance that someday I might get my sight back. She said, I could do one of two things. I could either sit down and feel sorry for myself and allow everyone to wait on me hand and foot and become a complete nothing and a vegetable, so to speak. Or, she said, I could do what there's so many, many blind people are doing today. I could get myself a seeing eye dog. I could learn to take care of myself and eventually take care of my house and even to cook. And she said, then if after a number of years I finally got my sight back, she said, I would be a better, more beautifully integrated, happier person than if I had sat in that chair and let people wait on me. And she said, isn't this Al-Anon? And I had to sit there and say, yes, this is Al-Anon. This is the thing that makes it possible for us to find peace and joy and happiness regardless of what's going on around us. And we find at long last that if we're wide open to hurt and to injustices and the things that normal people do sometimes, that we have a way that's shown to us here by so many, many people. And you talk about miracles. I have seen as many miracles in Al-Anon as any AA has ever seen in AA, believe me. Because I have seen many of you come to this program just ready to fall apart in all directions, looking like the wrath of God, hair awry, no makeup on, just looking like looking like hell, if you want to know. And watch them, little by little, day by day, come back to life. and that light come back in their eyes. And going back to this sense of humor thing, one of the things that we Al-Anons, I feel, and I feel it very, very definitely, need to encourage in our meetings especially, is a sense of lightness and of humor. I go to meetings that are so heavy sometimes that I go away feeling worse than when I went. I have talked at groups occasionally where I got absolutely nothing back. And it's the most difficult thing in the world to talk to a group like that, where they sit there. You can't make them smile, you can't make them laugh, you can't make them even change expression sometimes. And I feel that we in Al-Anon need to take a page from AA's book. We go to AA meetings and hear an alcoholic get up there on the platform and tell the most horrendous story you've ever heard in your life, and everybody just dies laughing. Let's learn from them. For goodness sake, you know why they die laughing? I think I've figured it out. If they didn't laugh at themselves, they'd die crying. And that's exactly what would happen to us if we did not try to develop this light touch, this sense of humor, this ability to laugh at ourselves. That's one of the greatest things that you've given me, is the ability to laugh at me and not take myself so seriously. Yes, it's a serious program. Yes, it's a beautiful program. But we don't need to treat it seriously. And it's so wonderful when we go to an up meeting where we talk about answers, not about problems. Because the answer is not in the problem. And that's something else that I have learned from my beloved husband. Our eye off the problem and start looking at and living in the answer, life would be so good to us. And the funny part of it is, when you dwell in the answer, the problem has a little way of disappearing, and you don't have to take it and shake it and make it go. And one of the things that I've had to learn is that an intellectual knowledge, as I said before, won't do you one bit of good in this program. It's taking the intellectual knowledge and acting like it was true. And I've had people say to me, but that's being hypocritical. I don't think so. How are you going to prove that something works if you don't act like it's true and prove it in your own life? And I can't tell you how much gratitude I have in my heart for this program and for the people in it. Because you see, you've given me back my family. You've given me back my home. You've given me back my own self-respect and my own dignity. And I bless you for that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Elsa. Our next speaker will be Winnie E. from La Puente.
It finally happened. My name is Winnie Eddy, and I'm still not sure I'm grateful. Shouldn't be so surprised that this day finally arrived, though, because quite a few years ago, when I graduated from this program, and before I came back for the postgraduate course, I confided in my sponsor that I didn't really think I needed much more. I had already been around about 3 months. And Eddie had come home from the hospital and loused the whole thing up again. And Wilma, in her infinite wisdom, said to me, "Well, think it over. And keep coming back. You know, you may never be a good example, but you'll... but you can always be a bad one." And here I am. But as Elsa said, we do all say, I think, in our own way, the same things, because even though we may be miles apart as far as situations are concerned, the feeling is always the same. And I sat over there, and I had to sit through my whole talk. You know, before I even had a chance to open my mouth. But I don't know. I'm just one of those people that has problems. And they don't seem to get any better. They just get different. That's... it's about the sum total of it. But... strange as it may seem, about 19 years ago, almost about this time of the year, I came to my first Al-Anon meeting. Now, I didn't come because I wanted to. I didn't come because I thought I should. And I didn't come for any of the reasons that a lot of people come. I came to get even with my husband. Because he'd had the nerve to write a letter to the Al-Anon central office and tell them that he thought there was something wrong with me. I don't think it would have made me quite as mad if he hadn't been in the nut house at the time. But my first impression of Al-Anon was that you couldn't all be too bright if you'd take that nut's word for anything, you know. But anyhow, I didn't come to Al-Anon, as I say, for any of the right reasons, and I didn't come back for any of the right reasons after that first meeting, because I pretty well had it figured out the first night I was there. It was a get-better program for those people that didn't have it on the ball, and I did. Of course, it was behind a locked, nailed-up front door, but... at least that didn't bother me at the time. But anyhow, I was confused, you might say. And strange as it may seem, when they called me and told me, or rather asked me, because I did have a choice, and to talk at this meeting, and they said, our topic is, let it begin with me. And I thought, here I am again. I'm confused, you know. And so I did what I always do. I went right to Lloyd John, and I said to him, "What does let it begin with me mean to you?" And he said, "Well, what are you talking about? You know, I mean, that isn't even a complete sentence." And he wasn't sure that it wasn't a question. But anyhow, I told him then. I said, "Well, that's the topic. That's the thing that we're going to talk about." And he said, "Well, you shouldn't have any problem with that. Everything begins with you." You know. And I discovered something that probably would have made my life a lot easier if I had known it before. You know, I always translate what he says into what I think. And when he said, "Everything begins with you," I thought he had accused me of starting things. And so I decided that I would make a little further research. Because, you see, this is the problem that I had with Al-Anon. I researched it. And as Elsa said, you can get it intellectually, but if you don't have it inside, you can't give it away. Because you only got it up here and you can't feel it down here. So I started on a search trying to figure out, what does it mean? Let it begin with me. And finally, I discovered that to everybody I asked, it meant something different. To some people, it meant release. To some people, it meant freedom. To some, it meant all kinds of things. But none of the things that it meant to them did it mean to me, which meant that I was still in trouble. And then I talked at a meeting, and I have a habit of ending my pitches now with a little story that I'm going to start this one with, because It was my answer. And it was the story of a little boy who wanted his father to read him the Sunday funnies, and the father didn't want to because he wanted to watch the football game or something. And the kid kept bugging him, so finally he took a piece of the rotogravure. I knew I wasn't going to be able to say that. He took a piece of the rotogravure section that had the world on it, and he tore it up in a bunch of little pieces, and he handed it to the little kid, and he says, "Here, go put the world together, and I'll read you the funny papers." And in a very short time, the kid was back, and there it was, the world, all scotch-taped together the way it was supposed to be. And the father looked at the kid, and he looked at the world, you know, and the football game was only half over, and but he'd made a promise. But it did puzzle him, so he said to him, he says, How did you ever get the world put back together so fast? And the little boy said, "Well, it wasn't hard." He said, "Because on the other side, there was a man, and I put the man together, and then the world came out all right." And each time that I've told that story, I have always said, I don't tell it for what it means to you. I tell it because I have to keep reminding myself from whence I came. I have to keep remembering what it used to be like. And when I told the story the other night, and the light suddenly dawned on me that this was the answer. This was how it began with me. Because, you see, I came to Al-Anon like a giant jigsaw puzzle, and nothing fit together. And yet all of a sudden, you helped me put me in the right place. And from that point on, it began with me. Be it good or bad, I started it, as I said, Eddie had said to me. Now, when I came to Al-Anon, I had a very difficult time because they hadn't written the program in the proper way. They had those steps so mixed up that you couldn't possibly come out right at the time you get to the end of them. Because if, in the first place, it asked me to admit that I was powerless over alcohol, which I wasn't, and that my life had become unmanageable, which it wouldn't have been if it hadn't been for him. And because of a slight error that my sponsor made in the very beginning when she told me that we use the same steps in Al-Anon that they use in AA, I had a little difficulty with that step, but only until that time that she gave me this statement, because as soon as I found out that AA had anything to do with it, I skipped that one, because that was Eddie's. The second one had an unfortunate word in it. You know, it said that I was supposed to be returned to sanity. And anybody that has any sense at all knows that if you're going to be returned, you got to be crazy first. And I wasn't, but he was. And so I left. And anybody that has any sense at all knows that if you're going to be returned, you got to be crazy first. And I wasn't, but he was. And so I left that one for him, too. But the third one asked me to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understand him. And in those days, I understood him, you know. He didn't understand me, but I understood him. I went through life trying to figure out what I had done for this kind of a penance, you know, because that's what I looked upon L.A. John as, sort of a penance for something bad that I'd done, and I really couldn't get back to how bad it had been. But I was scared to death of God. You know, I'd spent half my life in church. And I did everything that they wanted me to do. I decorated the altar. I sang in the choir. I even helped the priest. And nothing happened. I got to the place where it was so bad that when people would say to me, "Winnie, I'm praying for you," I'd say, "Please don't." You know. Because I had the feeling that every time they brought my name up, he remembered what I'd done. And actually, my prayers weren't doing much better because occasionally, you know, I thought, well, if I pray for somebody else, maybe it'll help. And when we were down in Holden, Missouri, where I had that dental office, there was a doctor down there that I kind of liked. And so I went to church one day and I told him I was going to pray for him. And about a week later, he came over to see me and he said, "Are you going to church Sunday?" And I said, yes, why? And he said, well, would you mind praying me out of the hole that you prayed me into last week? So that no matter which way I went, you see, I was in trouble with God. And so so I didn't like that third step at all. And I didn't really hate Eddie bad enough to turn him over, too, so I skipped it for both of us. Which is something that I think is interesting, particularly in my case. I don't know, maybe part of the hard time I had was that I had to work both programs, you see. Because I had to work his for him in order to make mine come out all right. I just never knew what step to work on him. That was the whole sum total of the thing. But anyhow, I finally got to the fourth step, which I rather enjoyed. Because it said, take a searching and fearless moral inventory. And I knew things about him that you wouldn't have believed. In fact, they don't believe him. So it's just one of those things. But anyhow, you can see that I was working the program in a speedy way. And I just jotted down a few of these good things that Eddie had done. And I'm ready for the fifth step, you know. Well, they told me in the beginning that it was a simple program. Of course, my sponsor also said it takes a little longer if you're stupid, and I hadn't heard that. But anyhow, I was ready for the fifth step. And this program was going along like a dream. And then I ran into some trouble, because I had a lot of telephone numbers of unsuspecting people, you know. They gave it to you thinking you'd never call, I guess. I don't know. But I really hadn't gotten into the program well enough to realize what the fifth step meant. I thought you just went around telling people what it was, you know, like the ancient mariner with that albatross that you got around your neck. But anyhow, I started on that phone call, you know, and it was the first time I realized how many cooks there were in Al-Anon, you know. Every time I'd get into the meaty part of this fifth step, somebody would say, I'm sorry, Winnie, but I got something on the stove. And I was getting a little nervous, so I got to the point where I finally called this one female, and the first thing I said to her was, are you cooking? And she said no, so I let her have it. And I only got about one juicy tidbit out before she made a very, very dastardly statement. She said, Winnie, I'm just... I haven't got the time for that crap. Now, I didn't really think that ladies used that kind of language. And certainly not in a program where you're supposed to be improving yourself. And so I called my sponsor. And I reported this female. I told her that I didn't think that this woman was practicing the principles of this program as they had been set down to me in the beginning. And I asked her to refer to the membership committee. And I guess Wilma figured that I was ripe or ready or something, I don't know. Because she said to me, Winnie, take the word alcohol out of the first step. Put your name in there. And then work it. And today, just like it was 19 years ago, when I say to you, I admitted I was powerless over Winnie and my life has become unmanageable, once again, it begins with me. You see, because for the first time in my life, the first time I said that, I knew without a shadow of a doubt who it was that loused up my life. It just took me 19 years to admit it. But it's one of the things, one of the blessings that I have received from this program. I had a terrible time with it because I fought it. I wanted it on an easy basis. Elsa mentioned to you the fact that I said I wanted to... What I really said was... If you'll excuse me. The first time I saw her, she had that calm, beautiful face. And I just knew everything was all right with her. Because I was one of those people that only looked at the outside. You know, I didn't care about the inside. Because I wasn't going to get in there anyhow. But I wanted to feel like she looked. And I went around trying to find out what it was that she did that I didn't do. And then one night I heard her husband talk at a meeting in Baldwin Park, and he told about her going to business school. And he mentioned that one of the things he thought hurried his entrance into Alcoholics Anonymous was her trying to learn to type. And all of a sudden, I looked over at her, and she looked entirely different. Because I know how to type. But you know, one of the strange things, whether you haven't found it out yet or not, I don't know what I'm going to say from one minute to the next. But anyhow, this is one of the things that I had to learn in Al-Anon, that even I went around looking pretty good. It was just the fact that on the inside I didn't look good, I didn't feel good, and I didn't know what to do about it. And when I finally got around to working these steps the way they were supposed to be worked, little by little, I began to feel the way Elsa looked. And I couldn't figure it out. To this day, I haven't been able to figure it out. Because Al-Anon is one thing that I have become involved in that I have never been able to figure out. I can't tell somebody else how to work this program. Now, that is a miracle in itself. Because I've always been able to tell other people what to do. But for some reason or other, and I think I learned this, really, in the Al-Anon program, because when I finally got around to where I knew I was going to have to work them steps between the first one and the 12th one, and I still didn't like them, I went from the first to the 12th. And I was making 12-step calls like they were going out of style, you know. Nobody lived too far for me to go and help. And one day my sponsor said to me, "Do you know what you're doing?" And I said, "Yes, I'm carrying the message." And she said, "No, you're not. You're carrying the disease." But anyhow, I was having one of my own particular little things, you know, moments of growth, as somebody said one time. And the telephone rang, and it was a 12-step call, and so I immediately put my misery on the shelf and rushed right over to bring, you know, good cheer to the poor thing that was suffering. And we talked for a while, but, you know, it was almost like walking into my past. This woman had a whole house full of kids, and she had her hair tied up in a bandana that looked very much like one that I had. And I kept it for years, you know. I was never sure when I might need it again, but But anyhow, it was just like my stepping into the past. And so I told her all the things that Wilma had told me. And she was just delighted. In fact, when I left, she said to me, "Thank you very much for coming. I feel so much better now than I did before." And I went away, you know, with that feeling with the halo that sits up there, you know, when you've done something good. I got in my car, closed the door, and I took my misery right back down off the shelf. And you know who I blamed? Her. Because she had said she felt better, and I didn't think she should. You see, because why should she feel better when I felt so bad? I'm the one that just made her feel good, and I feel terrible. And I couldn't figure out why until suddenly a little bird or a little thought or something, I don't know, suddenly popped into my head. She believed you. Why don't you believe you? And it was the beginning of my understanding that I can't tell you how to do it. I can only share with you what I have done, and then we both profit by what we have learned. Because each one of us in our own way walked our own road to hell. And as the girl from Canada once said to me, the only strange thing is that we waited so long to meet. Because we had no other way to go. I felt all of the feelings that Elsa described. But I was a different type, you see. Her husband talks all the time. Mine never says anything. She had trouble with going to AA meetings and not feeling like she was one of them. I felt right at home. In fact, there's some of them now that say to me, "If you ever decide to join the other side, don't call me." I don't suppose there's been anybody that's had as many rejects from AA as I have, but because I tried to join them, you know, right in the early days, because I didn't like Al-Anon. They kept talking about things I didn't like. They kept reminding me of things I'd been trying to forget. They were a lousy bunch, if you want me to give you the honest opinion. And besides that, they picked on me. And so I took the 20 questions test, and I flunked it. And so I went to the guy that I thought was the high mucky muck in our particular area, and I confessed, I'm an alcoholic. And he said, how do you know? I said, because I flunked your test. And he said, well, if you flunk the 20 questions test, the chances are maybe you are an alcoholic. When did you have your last drink? And I said, well, I don't know. About maybe 3 years ago? And he said, lady, if it's been 3 years since you've had a drink, go on back over there with them women. Let them see if they can help you. Because we weren't all that popular in Al-Anon in those days, you know. I don't know why, but that's the way it was. But anyhow, I realized, and I'm going back and forth, like I told you, you're getting it firsthand, just like I am. But after my search today, or my search this week, or however long it's been going on, I don't know. I lose all track of time. That's why they refer to me as the late Mrs. Eddy. I've never known whether it was my condition or my habits, but anyhow, I finally decided that this puzzle that I was putting together was made possible because the base of it was the last part of the 12th step, the same step that I had tried so many years ago to take to other people but couldn't get myself, practicing these principles in all my affairs. This is how it begins with me. It begins with me because, number one, I believe what you say. It begins with me because I want what you have. And it begins with me because I know from what you have told me that the only way I can keep it is to give it away. And that's what I try to do one day at a time. Not necessarily to those people who know what's going on, because when I'm working in the office with my husband, there are people who wonder, what the hell's the matter with that dental office, you know, because it has a different atmosphere. They don't come in with the idea that, you know, we're trying to be happy with them. And you'd be amazed at the number of people that don't know how to be happy, the number of people that are afraid to laugh, you know, because I had a little thing that I used to try out just for the heck of it, you know. I'd walk down the street and I'd pick out some unsuspecting fool and I'd say, hello. And then I walk on. And I go about 10 steps and then I turn around. He's still standing there. He's trying to figure out what's the matter with me, you know, because they don't know how it feels. There isn't that freedom of being able to be happy with everybody, whether you know them or whether you don't, because you don't really have to know people, which is something that I had to learn in this program in order to like them. Just a cheerful smile or a hello can mean the world to somebody that has never had anybody say it before. And nobody should know that better than me, because I went around for years trying to get somebody to mistake me for somebody else and say hello. But anyhow, I don't even know where I am now. You know, I'm one of those things. But I'm not going to worry about it, because she already said that if you don't like it, it's your fault. And so I'm not going to worry about it now, anyhow. But I wouldn't trade what I have today. I wouldn't trade the ability to laugh, even though a girl asked me Thursday night. She said, did you think it was this funny when you were living through it? No, I didn't. I didn't think it was funny at all. But I learned something when I came to Al-Anon that I hope she'll learn, too. That in Al-Anon, I found a place where I could laugh together about the things I used to cry about alone. Because there's nothing, regardless of how bad I think it is, that I don't have the freedom to share every time I go to a meeting. Now, that don't mean I always do. But the fact that I can seems to be the thing that gives me the freedom that I searched for so long. I don't know whether I'll survive another 19 years or not. It depends on how well Eddie gets, but but he's always coming up with these things, you know, that really tickle the heck out of me. This morning, you know, I used that little book the 24-hour daybook like a crystal ball. And I think it's one of the reasons that I have a difficult time with the ODAP book or and the 20, you know, I because when he was new and I was working his program, I used to look at that thing every morning, and then I would watch him to see if he was doing it. And, of course, he never read it, so he didn't know what I, you know. And if he wasn't doing it today, then I'd read yesterday to see if he was a day behind, or tomorrow to see if he was a day ahead. It was just one of those things. But anyhow, I asked him about 3 days ago, or four, what it meant to him, you know, let it begin with me. And aside from that snide remark he made, he hadn't really gone into it until this morning. And he said, Winnie, I have the answer. And I said, what's that? I'd forgotten the question. But I was going to let him go ahead and give me the answer, and he did. It was in that book. For today it says, when you're talking, don't try to make a polished speech. Don't try to give away something that you haven't got. Because a few sincere words from the heart mean more than an hour and a half of nothing at all. And that's what I've tried to do today. I've tried to give back to you a few of the laughs that you gave to me. I've tried to share with you the way I feel about this program, and it isn't easy. Because I know how I feel, and I can feel right now how I feel, but I can't find the adequate words to put across to you what it really means, because how do you thank somebody for giving you back your life? How do you thank somebody for giving you the courage to go on? It just ain't possible. But because each and every chair in this room is filled with somebody who is letting it begin with them, I'm here today, and I thank God and I thank you for that privilege. I'm going to close with a poem. I very rarely read from the podium, but I'm doing this, and I'm doing it for a very special reason, because one of the people that I surveyed in my search was my mother. And yesterday, she's been ill, and she wasn't feeling very well, and so I had to make a trip back up to Roland Heights. And just before I left, she said to me, you know, you asked me about this talk, let it begin with me. And she said, I think I have something that may help you. And she gave it to me to read. And if I don't cry, I'm going to read it. Because I could have read this in the beginning, you could have all gone out and had coffee. But it, to me, it is beautiful, and it says the whole thing in just a very few words. Is there anybody happier because you passed his way? Does anyone remember that you spoke to him today? The day is almost over and its toiling time is through. Is there anyone to utter now a kindly word for you? Can you say tonight in parting with the day that's slipping past that you helped a single brother of the many that you passed? Is a single heart rejoicing over what you did or said? Does the man whose hopes were fading now with courage look ahead? Did you waste the day or lose it? Was it well or sorely spent? Did you leave a trail of kindness or a scar of discontent? As you close your eyes in slumber, do you think that God will say, you have earned one more tomorrow by the work you did today?